And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Monday, March 1st. Feels good to flip the calendar to a new month, especially given the prolonged winter we've been dealing with here in Wisconsin. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris, and it feels like baseball season is actually just around the corner. We've got spring games on TV, we've got games on the radio, we've got drafts starting up. TGFBI started today. I'm in a league similar to the Barf League that Eno is in. It's called GLARF. It's the Great Lakes version of that. So a Midwest League. That's a slow draft that started up. Oh. Our friends over at Prospects Live have a Best Ball Dynasty slow draft that started up today. So I have three slow drafts that all started today. And, of course, the chaos of everything else for the season descending upon us, too. How's it going for you on this Monday, Eno?
It was good. Chaos, scattered thoughts, trying to like get in front of a draft widget and remember what team it was and what's going on and like what the settings were and where your auction calculator tab is for that one. And like just, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Watching Matt, I don't even know his first name, Shoemake, somebody named Shoemake. Just grounded out against somebody named McCarthy. So,
that's what you want.
I'm a fan. Listen, I'm a fan of names on the back of jerseys because there's a lot of players in baseball, and in spring in particular, there's so many more that I don't have the patience to get like the media guide for every single team and be like, okay, number 69 is. So anyway, that's life right now. I'm on the clock right now. You are on the clock.
Oh, this is a good reminder to anybody out there who is in a slow draft to mute the tab if you are working in an office again. Fantrax in particular notoriously has the loud air horn on by default. Like the NFBC sound kind of sounds like an announcement's going to be made on an airplane. It's just the ding, ding, just very soft, very pleasant. And then there's the you are on the clock, right? That happens on a few different rooms.
You are on the clock.
But the hard air horn sound on Fantrax will make you jump and will surprise you and will embarrass you, as our friend Vlad Sedler pointed out, if you are in a meeting when that thing goes off.
Let this also be proof that sometimes when you're waiting on someone to make their pick, they're just out there podcasting.
They're just, also that.
You know, not doing their pick. They're just... Get out of the booth, make your pick. You have to have some patience, man. These 2 4-hour segments, sometimes they'll take the whole four hours. Sometimes I forgot to put auto on. I'm on the West Coast, you know? I went to sleep. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry they had to wait the 2 hours, but you know, I think we'll get the draft done.
There's a little bit of etiquette in the slow draft, too. The TGFBI league I'm in, Jeff Zimmerman's in it. He's got the 9th pick. I'm picking 11th. He's planning on picking Shane Bieber, and Shane Bieber is about to make his Cactus League debut. So he chatted the room and just said, I've got a few hours on the clock. I'm going to wait and just make sure that Bieber gets through his outing healthy, and then I'll draft him. It's my first pick. I'm not going to take a guy and then have him get hurt the very first time he pitches in a game in spring training, which is fine. It's a slow draft for a reason. Feel like if you're going to wait like that, just let the room know, so that way people aren't checking back every 5 minutes waiting, you know, anticipating that you're going to actually make that pick.
For the record, I have the 9th pick. I'm considering Bieber, which I've never taken a pitcher in the first round. And I'm, for the record, I'm just podcasting.
Nice of you to be honest about that.
I may check in. I may check in on the Bieber situation after the podcast is over.
I mean, yeah, his outing will be done by the time we wrap this up, so that works out really well for you. But you've really never drafted a pitcher in the first round before?
I've never done it. Never done really? It before, yeah.
I mean, part of that's probably that you believe one of your strengths as a player is finding plenty of pitching later, so pushing pitching really early is less of a priority for you, but is this going to be different this year?
I don't know. Some of it is also just like gross, deep-seated bias of against pitchers, and it's just old. It's old. Like, I've been playing I'm old now. I've been playing baseball, fantasy baseball, since like 2002. And when I started, I said, I'm not drafting a pitcher until the 10th inning. I'm going to whoop your pants. I hope I didn't say that.
Is that what you said? Yeah, how you talk trash back then?
Never been a particularly good trash talker. Anyway, I'm not going to take a pitcher to the 10th and I'm going to beat your behind.
Are those people still your friends? Man.
I never talk trash.
That's like Pete Weber celebrating his U.S. Open championship. That was just circulating again because it was an anniversary for that event.
What did he say? Something?
Who do you think you are? I am.
Anyway, my point was I used to take pitchers in the 10th, start taking pitchers in the 10th, and it worked because I didn't think we were as good at seeing who were good pitchers, like, you know, identifying the good pitchers we weren't as good at. You know, I think I think it was the pace of draft it worked for back in the day, because I think everyone took pitchers later, and then so if everyone takes their pitchers later, then you can wait even later and still get, like, I was still getting like two top 20 guys and picking in the 10th, you know. So I don't know, it's been a long sort of slow process for me of being like, nah, I got to take pitchers early. They make up X amount of the roster, X percent of the roster, and the very best pitchers can be worth just as much as the very best hitters. And, you know, injury is just the chaos that comes for us all. And it's just, you have to pay the piper and get the best pitchers. So I'm thinking about Bieber, but I also got my man Christian Yelich there, and like I really think he's gonna like 35-20, like 275, 35-20, and I'm just like, man, I don't really want to give that up.
I don't either. I am in the 11th spot, and I'm glad that Jeff is planning on taking Bieber. I want Bieber to be healthy just because I don't want players to get hurt, but you know, it's either gonna be Yelich or Trevor Story, depending on what the team next to me does. They could very well take Yelich, and you know, I'm not going to get him. But I do find myself not wanting to draft Bieber. I'm comfortable drafting DeGrom. I'm comfortable drafting Cole. I'm comfortable drafting a bunch of the starting pitchers that we see consistently going in round two. I just can't figure out what it is about Bieber that I don't actually like in the moment. Even though when I step back and look at the numbers, and look at the underlying skills, it all makes sense. It's reflected in the rankings. I think he belongs in the late part of round one. But every single time in the moment, whether it is a draft or an auction, I talk myself out of it. I don't go the extra dollar if it's an auction, and I decide to go with one of the hitters instead if I'm in a position where Bieber's out there.
But it's not a pitching general thing. So like if Cole, I was like at 9 looking at 7 and Cole was still out there, and I was like, whoa, what? I think if Cole gets to me, then I'm definitely taking him. I don't know why I'm hesitating more on Bieber when their projections are pretty similar. But so if you had Cole, chance at Cole, you would take him in the first round.
Yeah, absolutely. No hesitation whatsoever in that same spot. I would take Gerrit Cole.
I mean, you know, it is interesting that he was a command, you know, 88, 89 mile an hour JUCO kind of prospect, you know, just not on people's radars. And even as he started to put velocity on, of course, yeah, then the prospect, he got on prospect list. I'm not saying that everybody missed on him. Please don't construe my words that way. But I'm just saying that, like, it's a bit of a pop-up guy. Cole is a little bit more of a, you know, was he first overall, like top three pick, just blew through the minors, throws super wicked had. I don't know. I think it's
bias on my part for sure to not want to take Bieber. That's the main reason that I keep coming back to is I look at the scouting reports from when he came up, and it's like those probably don't matter that much anymore. We've seen him at the highest level do what he's done. So what analysts and evaluators thought he was going to be 2 and 3 years ago probably doesn't matter anymore. And yet in my head, it seems to have some sort of value.
Yes, it doesn't really matter at some point when you, but it's not like his track record is so voluminous.
Nice.
That that you can be like, oh, we know who he is now. There is a little bit of like, well, you know, his best season was a short season and, you know, he was giving up some homers before and some hard contact. And, you know, Alex Chamberlain has famously pointed out some of Bieber's shortcomings inside the zone in terms of the hard contact he gives up. So, and that could be related to not having the overpowering stuff, right? But at the same time, like, I think what we're looking at is like Kyle Hendricks with velocity.
Which would be a really fun add-on for Kyle Hendricks.
Is that a right? It's not a perfect corollary because they, you know, Kyle Hendricks is the changeup guy, blah 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 blah. But like, I think we're talking about like plus command with 94 instead of plus command at whatever Kyle Hendricks throws, like 90, 89, 90, 88.
A lot of 88.
This
89.
Is the face I make when I talk about 88. 88 miles an hour makes me make this face.
Yeah, the 88 face. So I need to get over it. I need to get past my fear of Shane Bieber in the first round because everything appears to be in place for him to continue to return value of a top five starting pitcher. So if I solve it, I'll let you know what the issue is.
I was also doing some Eat This, Not That, and like Buehler's projections are really similar, man. Just really similar. I think that the biggest difference, you know, when I did auction calculator, the thing that's really killing me is it's like $44 for Bieber and $37 for Christian Yelich. And I'm like, God, that's seven. That's like that's pretty big. But when I like looked at the projections, it's mostly a volume thing. Buehler and Bieber's per inning projections are pretty similar. I don't know why Zips is like, has a fairly wide discrepancy. Zips has Bieber at like a 3.5 ERA and Buehler at a 3.1 ERA. So Zips is telling me to wait and take Buehler. It's time. It's time for those big long sighs and push the button.
Yeah, and swearing at the screen when things don't break the way you want.
Super busy. I'm in a long draft and hold. What's it called? OC, the OC champions or whatever. OC
draft champions. That's DC.
Draft champ DC. Yeah. So I'm in a draft and hold, and we're at like 430 in terms of picks, and I just screamed at my computer. I hope my wife didn't hear me. I just screamed at my computer because someone took Max Stassi.
Like, all the reasons to go on tilt, that's not one of them.
You bastard! Sniped me at 438.
You can't get sniped on Max Stassi anywhere, and you can't get sniped on anybody at 438. Exactly. This is not a snipe.
Wait,
this is just
long.
The draft happening. Yeah. Well, with games happening, with things happening, with news actually breaking, we talked about this a bit on Friday, the best shape of his life stories, of course, those don't mean a whole lot. At least that's what Ben Lindbergh's study found. They're not completely meaningless, but they're not necessarily as meaningful as we'd like. It brings us to a broader question of what matters when we're watching baseball and we're watching baseball news in the spring. And if you look at RotoWire or former Roto World, now NBC Sports Edge, you look at the news pages there, it's a great way to stay on top of the information. You'll see a whole variety of different things. You'll see guys pitching a scoreless inning. You'll see someone working on a new pitch. You'll see a minor injury, right? Anthony Rendon's not playing on Monday due to soreness. It's unspecified soreness. It's just soreness. He's just 31, and he started doing more exercise last week, so he's a little sore. I can relate to that. But then you get to stuff like this. Xander Bogaerts had an MRI on his shoulder, and the MRI came back negative, so it doesn't seem like anything that's going to cause us to drop Bogaerts too far in rankings. But it might actually be something, because when you look at a news aggregator, you see a headline and you see the person who gathered that information, you see their spin on what happened. And sometimes in putting those news items together, the original information gets slightly lost. And this is not at all a shot at people that do this. This is just explaining how the process works. This is how the sausage is made. You need to click through the links when you look at news on those sites, because the quotes from the team sometimes shed a little extra light on just how serious something might be. In this case, if you look at the quotes, and the original piece came from Jason Mastrodonato, I believe Jason is with the Boston Herald. If you look at the original quote from Chaim Bloom, it makes you feel a little more pessimistic than you'd feel if you only read the player note. So the quote from Chaim Bloom, "Nothing concerning, no, all what you would expect. He should be ready, parentheses, for opening day. Obviously, we won't skip steps with him. It's a marathon, not a sprint, but we should have the time we need," end quote. That to me says, we expect him back playing in spring games before opening day, but we're not going to push it, which would suggest some kind of like 1 to 2 week injury or absence, a very minor, you know, strain sort of issue, no structural damage. But if we're going to take Bogaerts out of action for a couple of weeks and we're going to say there's a non-zero chance that he misses opening day, that does probably knock him down a couple of spots, even if he doesn't even fall more than a half round in ADP over these next couple of weeks.
Yeah, nothing in the MRI ignores the fact that there was something that created the need for an MRI. And everything was all clear in the MRI. And then there are steps, you know, to this process, means that this is like an actual thing. This is an actual injury of some sort that requires rest. That's step one. And then sort of some sort of rehab, step two. That's the normal process, you know? So it's not like he stubbed his toe, he's out today, you know? I would take soreness, man, even if that suggests something about how he's feeling age-wise. I think it's much more nebulous and there's no steps. The step is he's going to sit on his ass today. Tomorrow hopefully won't be sore. So, I don't know. I think that you have to ding Bogaerts a little bit here. Especially, you know, we're still seeing a ton of big homers. We saw a beautiful, beautiful big homer from Gary Sanchez today, which cleared the batter's eye and just looked like a 600-foot dong. But, if the ball is deadened at all, I think that Bogaerts could be one of the guys who loses a little bit. Now, if he misses a week and the ball's deadened, and he's a 280 guy who hits 22 homers this year, are you taking him in the right spot?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm looking at him, so without accounting for the shoulder, I've got Bogaerts behind Alex Bregman and Anthony Rendon, very tightly clustered together. I've got Bogaerts ahead of Manny Machado. The market doesn't have that. ADP has Machado 12 spots ahead of him.
Especially now, I take Manny.
Right, I'd flip Manny over Bogaerts now. I'd probably take Ozzie Albies over Bogaerts right now. And again, this is based on what we know on Monday, March 1st. Thursday could roll around and Bogaerts could be playing in a spring game again and you flip it back. But if you're drafting
there are fewer
today,
steps than we thought.
Right, but if you're drafting Monday, you're drafting Tuesday or Wednesday, you know what you know right now, and you do want to account for this information without overreacting to it. So I would probably lower Bogaerts to probably my 21st hitter. That would put him behind Machado, behind Albies, behind Devers, and behind Bo Bichette. I think I'd still take Bogaerts over Adalberto Mondesi if that were my decision. Or I might just go to the pitching side and take a pitcher and let someone else deal with it.
Some dude just hit Rake Lamb on the knee. Ay, ay, ay. Should we have a hierarchy, an injury hierarchy? Which are the worst injuries? It is meaningful because, let's say Jake Lamb's knee is broken, right? Like, that's obviously something broken or torn that's the top tier. That's like, oh, crap. Like, do not draft, I think, right? Because we don't, like, if something's broken or torn, you don't even know how broken or torn it is. And you don't know what the thing is. If there's surgery involved, you at least don't have that, like, it's stupid to hear, but you don't have that, well, it was what we expected, you know, like everything went according to plan sort of thing. Because there are surgeries where they go in, they're like, well, we thought we were taking some chips out, but TJ. So anything broken or torn, obviously, I think they go right into do not draft. I want to know so much more, at least a temporary do not draft, right? Until maybe some more news comes out. And then I think in the next level of like, oh, soreness, we don't know what's going on, we're taking a step back. I have body parts that I care about more than others. So I think shoulder, people talk about elbow, but you know, there are guys who like Tanaka, slightly torn elbow, managed to be great for a long time. And like, I have a feeling that the like, pitcher's elbows, like most of the time they hurt, I think. And so, elbow doesn't worry me so much. Shoulder, I don't want to hear anything about a shoulder. That means it's starting to creep up the kinetic chain or whatever. It's trying to creep up into the bigger parts of their body. That means something's worse there. So I don't really want to hear about shoulders. And here's a surprising one that bothers me. Obliques. It's really tricky because sometimes you can really have like a 2-day oblique thing where it's just like, it's just sore today. But then you can also have a 2-day thing that becomes a 5-day thing, you know, becomes like a 2-week thing. Even if they're, when they're playing, they're not getting the same bat speed. They're not getting the same arm speed, whatever it is. Like, this is a game of obliques. Like, I think I would actually drop a guy down a little bit just if I heard him saying something about his obliques.
This is a game of obliques. Like, I just never heard you would say it that way.
You know, it's very rotational. It's definitely an obliques game.
Yeah, it definitely impacts hitters and pitchers in a pretty significant way. Usually it's an IL stint. Usually it's a couple of weeks at the earliest before a player comes back from something like that. A lot of times it's even like 4 to 6. So I'm right there with you. I think there are different categories of injuries, different body parts we're more concerned about than others, especially this time of year.
And because of Britt, I'm a little bit more aware of calf muscles now. Britt and Josh Donaldson together have like... Because remember what Britt was saying, that like sprint speed is the thing that you lose the quickest on Friday.
Right.
So you're saying sprint speed is the thing you like sprint fitness is the thing you lose the quickest. And I believe that actually, because I'm trying to do some running and, you know, I read about running training and a lot of them are like, you have to run 5 days a week. You'll start losing running fitness on the order of 1 or 2 days. And I've seen it where like, oh, my calf or oh, my Achilles, I'm going to take a week off or something. When I start back up again, I'm like, what? 5 miles feels like a marathon again. What? What? And I've been trying to get back up. Like I ran like 11 miles last year and I've been trying to get my max run back up to that. And I'm talking about like last August, I ran 11 miles. I got to 9 last week, but, you know, it's been a slog, you know, just because I took like a week off in December. So running speed, anything that makes them that they can't run means that I think it would be hard for them to play baseball.
Yeah, that ramp back up takes a little bit of time to get back to the previous level.
Yeah, it was so bad for him.
But what else moves the needle this time of year? It's not just injury information that we're seeing. We're seeing velocity reports. We're seeing new pitches, right? Jason Collette's been doing the new pitch tracker for a while. And new pitches, I think, are a little bit deceiving because a guy throws a pitch in a Grapefruit League game or a Cactus League game doesn't mean he trusts that pitch enough to throw it when the games count. So I think we can be sometimes quick to jump in on a new pitch and say, oh, he's got a third pitch now. Oh, he's got another pitch he can use against lefties. And then that pitch is an absolute ghost once we turn the page and get to April.
And we don't get the all-important pitch percentages. So they could talk about, you know, having thrown their new cutter in the game or whatever. And we don't even know if he's talking about throwing, you know, 10% or he threw two cutters and called it a day. Because we don't, like, I honestly don't really think a person owns a pitch on the major league level until they throw it at least like 8% of the time. You know, if they throw something 3 to 5% of the time, nobody game plans for that. Nobody is like worried about that pitch. It's just a surprise pitch. Probably not a very good pitch. They don't trust it enough. So we don't even know those percentages. And actually, the way that those that percentages and the stints that they pitch in work is also relevant for velocity. Because I would say generally, big up in velocity is good, big down is bad. And there's enough research that shows that these big movements are meaningful. But there is also research that shows that spring training velo changes are not that useful. And I think it's because you'll have guys come out for what are they doing now? One inning stints, right? And then, you know, a couple weeks it's two or three innings. You know, they're adding like an inning or two every time they go out. And so you'll see a guy like DeGrom will sit 99 for his whole first inning of work. Well, he knows he's only going to throw 25 pitches today. You know what I mean? And it's DeGrom, so he's going to air it out and get on the social media and like everyone's you know, laughing about it. And yes, I do think DeGrom throws hard, and I'm not saying he doesn't, but I'm saying that it may not be that useful because he may sit where he sat last year. And then I remember everyone was like, Yu Darvish touched 97 today. And I'm like, Yu Darvish's max velo last year was 97. You know? So
it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to throw harder.
Right. So you got to put everything in context. You'd be like, what are you giving me? Are you giving me a max number or a sits number? If you're giving me a sits number, tell me how many innings he threw. If he sat this for three innings and it's plus one or two ticks over last year, then I'm starting to listen. You know, it has to be, it has to have some volume to it. It has to be voluminous.
Word of the day.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm looking at this time of year is new defensive positions. Similar to testing out a pitch, doesn't necessarily mean a team's going to actually play a guy in that new spot when the games begin to count. But I think that might be a greater indicator of intent, comparatively speaking. Like dabbling with a new pitch, yeah, that might disappear. But you know, we saw Gene Segura last spring, the last live baseball game that I got to see was a spring training game with you. It was Orioles, Phillies, and Clearwater. Mm-hmm. And Gene Segura was playing his new position. That wasn't a secret at the time, but I think he was playing third the day we saw him, and previously people expected him to play second, right? Just getting a sense for how pieces fit, especially when a new player was added to the mix. I think in those situations, seeing how the defensive alignment works is actually something I'm pretty interested in, because we're talking about paths for players to qualify at new positions and they become multi-position players soon after the season begins, which in a lot of formats becomes a way of adding a little bit of extra value after draft season.
Yeah, I mean, in related news, Segura is actually one of my guys so far in drafts, it looks like. I like him just because he's going to give you a little bit of power and speed. And also, 2B/3B is a rare mix in these days and makes you MI and CI. So it's really a four-position guy that gives you a little bit of power, a little bit of speed. I don't know, like it's worked out that I needed something like that at the right time and the price was right, so I'll point that out about Segura. But then also, I like what you're saying about like organizational future, organizational desires. Like I was thinking about Ty France with regards to this. I saw Ty France is mostly taking ground balls at third base. That's a little awkward because they have a third baseman in Kyle Seager. And so you might just say, you know, whatever, he's just expanding his versatility, you know. However, I then went to Corey Brock and said, you know, what's the deal with Ty France usage? I feel like he's the starting DH, but he's taking the balls at third. Does that mean he's going to replace Seager when Seager leaves? And yeah, Brock was like, yeah, that's how I see it too. So that means, you know, headed towards third base in the future, most likely to, you know, to be third base eligible after this year, I would say. But also tells you something about like, how the organization values him. Like they're more likely to play him at DH and have him actually be a starter all year if they think he's going to be their third baseman in 2022. And so I gave Ty France a little nudge upwards, you know. The guy can probably hit, and they have a position in mind for him. So that definitely, I think it's a little bit stronger than, you know, taking ground balls at is weaker than played in the game at. But there's still some right. Signal to that noise.
Yeah, and just comparing that to how relievers are deployed, I would say reliever usage doesn't give us much of anything in spring training, because a lot of teams are going to prioritize their high leverage relievers earlier in the game, soon after the starters leave, because they want the high leverage relievers to face actual major league hitters as opposed to upper level minor league guys that enter the game late. So if Giovanni Gallegos pitched the ninth inning on Sunday, regardless of the score, it doesn't really mean all that much. It doesn't mean he's closer or further to save chances based on that usage.
The fifth. I have to say that I'm finding it harder to understand the quality of competition right now. Because, yeah, I think normally in the past, like, you're right, they would bring the closers out. Sometimes the closers would open games because they would be like, okay, we're making sure that you're gonna play the best bats today. So we're gonna get you in here right at the beginning of the game. But now that we're down to seven inning games, and have these weird things where, like, I'm pretty sure I watched Garrett Richards walk off the mound with two outs because he hit 20 pitches. And I think that they were
they
just
could
like,
just be like, we're yeah, good.
That's the end of that inning.
Done.
Which actually, you know what, dude? I mean, these games don't count. You know, if it's supposed to be developmental, then that's fine. It doesn't bother me. But as a, you know, as an analyst, it makes it a little bit harder because now you're like, you know, this guy who's a closer candidate came in the, you know, the third and, you know, mopped the floor with them. I have no idea who he faced. In the third, they might have already taken out the hitters because today's a five inning game.
You know? if they're gonna mess around with game lengths, I have to imagine they're gonna have to lower the price of spring training tickets. You can't expect people to pay borderline regular season prices for spring training tickets if you're gonna cut the game in half and barely play guys that are actual major leaguers. I mean,
spring training is.
They won't necessarily, but right. it is just like an attempt to print money. And now they're even like, well, players, if you don't really want to play, or if teams, you don't really want to put that guy out there, you don't have to.
It's 20 fine. Pitches. Just call it quits. Yeah, no, I think spring training is very weird. I mean, I don't know if everyone knows, but like the players aren't paid for it. So right. The players aren't paid for it, and they're taking money at the gate, even if the you know, tickets are cheaper, like, they're still taking money at the gate. I'm sure that they make money off of spring. And it's 6 weeks long, you know. They're making money off of this. The players, and they're giving the players free food and, like, some sort of little stipend and being like, woohoo.
Which, I mean, if you're an established big leaguer, okay, your situation's a little bit different. But for the guys that are fighting for roster spots, for the guys that didn't get big bonuses, we talk about this group of players all the time. Like, they're in
they'll save the
spots.
Stipend and eat as much as they can of the free food. I mean, they're like in college when, like, I used to get prodded and zapped for, like, you know, the $10, you know, whatever. It's come participate in my study.
Free pizza.
Free pizza. I'm like, all right, I'm there.
You will be here for 3 hours. We will stab you with needles and take yeah. your blood. But you get free pizza. And you're like, yeah, 3 hours, free pizza? That sounds about right. I'll give that a shot for some free pizza.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, I'm glad to have the games back. As weird as they are, as broken up as they are, and as limited in talent as they are in some instances, still better to have it than to not, especially given some of the alternatives. All right, you know, let's get to auction strategy thoughts. We've got the labor auctions coming up this weekend, and we have an online conference, third week in a row, with some cool stuff happening on the weekend. First Pitch Florida would have been in person, obviously, with the pandemic. That is on hold, but the event is happening online. Our friends at Baseball HQ are putting that together. You've got a presentation on Saturday. I'm moderating. Basically, we're having an episode of Rates and Barrels live as part of the conference is the the real thing, I guess, that's
kind of
happening.
Yeah, when you said presentation, I was like, what?
It's it was on the rundown, it says an hour with Eno. So
I mean,
it could be anything.
I'm okay with it because, you know, like Pitcherless did, we did the same thing. We just sat and talked for a little bit, and I'm all right with it because it takes a lot less work and a lot less prep work and like presentation. Woo. Miss me on that.
The deep data. No, we'll talk about some of the cutting edge stuff that's happening.
Yeah, I have hours with me all the time. I have hours and hours and hours with me.
Well, you got a little time to come up with the final strategy, but I'm sure you put some significant thought into how you're going to approach the AL labor auction this weekend and just auctions as a whole. You know, we've talked about them on this show before, usually around this time of year, because it's a good time to start digging into those strategies. What's unique for you auction-wise going into 2021? Is there anything that's very different about your approach? You mentioned earlier that you don't usually draft pitchers in the first round. I assume that means you don't often pay $30-plus dollars for an ace in an auction, but are you more likely to pay up in an auction where you have more flexibility with how the rest of your roster comes together?
Yeah, I've been moving actually slightly towards a model of... So my hitting model generally is to try and get the cheapest stud. And what I've found is that my projections always kind of come under on the top players. So like my top player will be like for the longest time, my top player would be Trout for like $35 and he'd go for 40. And I just didn't feel like I wanted to push past my values that much. And what I tried to basically get was get a $30 player for 30, you know, instead of paying 40 for a $35 player. So that means that I get, it's almost like a two second rounder approach. You know, it's like a, you know, I'm going to get 2 second rounders. I have to pay this. There will be times where you just have to pay all the way to your value, maybe a dollar or two more. Maybe I have to pay 31 to get my 30, but you know, I'm going to get one of those. I'm not going to get the number one player. And I'm going to try and pay at my value. And that actually pushes my hitting into the middle. So what I end up doing is not having many dollar players, maybe having just $1 outfielder or a dollar utility player, because even like a $2 or $3 bid at the end game can be really powerful. You know, when people are, they're like, oh, that guy's still out there and someone's trying to sneak him in a dollar and you got $2, bam, you just got... you know, the best of the end game guys, you know, and $1 players, hitters, a lot of times are either small side platoon or not even set for playing time. And in like an AL labor type situation, I want to buy playing time. So on the hitter end, I do push towards the middle a little bit. I will try to get like some second rounder types, but I will push towards the middle, try to have a really balanced, buy a lot of innings and plate appearances. On the pitching side, I had been moving towards a stars and scrubs approach where I will buy Aroldis. Like I bought last year, I bought Aroldis Chapman, or 2 years ago, it was Aroldis Chapman and Luis Severino. That was my idea, you know? It didn't work out, but that was my idea that I was going to like push towards the get one really good ace, one really good closer, and then just buy a bunch of cheap arms after that. But I think. This year, I may do more of a push towards the middle on both. So I feel like pitching is pretty hard to project right now, and putting all my eggs in one basket, pitching-wise, I guess it could be Cole, but I think Cole will also get that like $35 for $40 type situation, right? Where like he will push the market for pitching. And then behind Cole, specifically in this pool, the AL pitching pool, I just don't see an all eggs in one basket type pitcher where I just want to be like, yeah, I'm going to put $32 on this guy and ride him all the way to victory.
Yeah, and the NL side is similar in that you've got DeGrom kind of up in a tier of his own, right? He's going to be probably a $38 to $40 pitcher, I would guess, in the NL auction this weekend. And you've got that next cluster behind him, which is pretty nice in the NL. The NL pitching depth lends itself to, hey, you missed out on DeGrom, but you could either get one from the next group, you could jam in two from the next group if you really wanted to. And it just feels like, especially since we're tracking toward not having the DH in the NL, there's a lot of mid-tier guys that you're more comfortable with now. Guys you'd be worried about if they were facing the extra good hitter in the middle of the lineup, but now they're getting the pitcher spot instead, so that pool seems to run a lot deeper now as long as that rules change holds up. But I'm comfortable paying up at the top for DeGrom. I think he's done it for enough years. He's, to me, not that much of an injury risk, not much more than a typical pitcher, even though he had the TJ a few years back. I trust the skills completely. My top dollar on him, am I going to 40 for him? I don't know if I'm going quite that high. I if it stops closer to 35 or 36, I'll get him. If not, fine, I'll build some other ways. The one thing that I think is also tricky with pitching, though, is figuring out how you want to attack closers in an auction. Because in snakes, like we talked about in the reliever preview, you're really forced to pass up on some good players, whether that's SP3 types or nice bats to kind of round out the meat of your lineup. You're passing on really good players where you're drafting closers. I don't feel that same shame in an auction. I feel like I can still get a lot of guys I really like, even if I do spend up and pay 20 or 22 or something on Josh Hader. I think the problem I have in the NL specifically, though, I don't know of the cheap closers this year. I still don't know if there are that many I actually even want. Because in labor, we can't take players out of our lineups. And I don't want to have Stefan Crichton just in my lineup all the time, right? I don't want him to blow up my ratios and lose the job.
4.6 ERA. Woohoo!
Yeah, I can't deal with that. Or even like Craig Kimbrel. Like, I think Kimbrel sort of makes sense in mixed league drafts where he goes. He's kind of the reverse Freddie Freeman. Like, I always say that in the early rounds, like in the first round of a draft, I don't want to draft Freddie Freeman. I'll buy Freddie Freeman at an auction. I'll draft Craig Kimbrel in a snake draft. I'm not necessarily going to pay $13 for him as a closer, right? Like, it's funny how the players you're interested in can shift a little bit just because of the flexibility you have in an auction versus that opportunity cost that you have to go through going one pick at a time in a snake.
Yeah, the shape of the player pool is really important, because you can have your values, and this year, and as I have in the past, I have ATC, custom ATC values. Shout out to Ariel Cohen. He provides me some custom ATC values for AL labor. But I also run the bat, and I have four numbers. I have ADP values, I'll have ATC values, I'll have the bat values, and I'll have what they earned last year. And I'll have those four values in a row just in front of me to look at. Of course, they'll be sorted by one. I won't tell you which one. And one of those numbers will be a no-go for me, will represent like the ceiling for me. But it's nice to have a range there in numbers wise. But beyond that, there's the shape of the player pool. So in a snake draft, like, remember we did the analysis for KDS for snake drafts, and we're talking about, like, well, if you take, you know, if you have the 11 pick, then you're going to end up probably with Yelich and Buehler, right? And we end up having a really basic draft where I almost followed ADP all the way without even meaning to. The same thing will happen in an auction. It's a slightly different, but it'll be like, if I sink my resources into this player, these are the things that I will get from it, right? And then I will have less, you know, I'll have fewer resources to buy. So, like, just to give an example, if I do sink a lot of my money into Freddie Freeman, it is almost like a snake draft. If I do sink my money into Freddie Freeman, I'm buying a first baseman and batting average and power, and I will need to, therefore, sink my second most resources into someone who's different than that. It almost works like a snake, but you can choose what that second most resource will be. You have more power, but you probably will have some effect from buying Freddie Freeman. It means that your second guy will be somebody that is, like, maybe it's a Starling Marte type, right? Where it's like, I need steals mostly from this guy, and I want to spend, my second most expensive guy will probably be like sort of $20 to $25. These are the guys that, so if I buy Freeman, this is what we talk about with, like, decision trees. If I buy Freeman, I bought power and first base and floor and all this stuff. My next guy will, maybe it'll be Keston Hira, because you know, he's a second baseman that will steal some bases and have maybe have a bad batting average. That pairs pretty well with Freeman. But that's, I ended up doing these little, almost like, it's like a mock draft, and you can just do the mock draft, but I don't have enough time to do tons of mock drafts. So I will do a mock draft in my head, where I'm like, I just basically fill out a roster. You know what I mean? Like, I'll have a roster out, and I'll be like, okay, if I buy Devers with my most money, or if I buy Jose Ramirez with my most money, or if I buy, you know, this is what happens after that. I'll end up spending here and here, and I'll look at the different teams, and I'll say, you know what, I kind of like it more when I start with Devers than when I start with Bregman, or when I, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll do it like that too, where I'm actually either through the RotoWire draft software, which I've always used, or just taking Excel or a piece of paper, I'm going to go through the auction values. What does my roster look like if I spend 40 on my best hitter, and then if I buy three $30 players and a few $20 players, what's the rest of my roster going to look like? What combination of skills can I get if I allocate resources that way? There's only a handful of $40 players. So if that $40 player is DeGrom, like if I do go to 40 on him, I feel like that's the right choice.
Where am I going to, yeah, where?
What's going to hurt me later? Yeah. Like what $30 hitters am I going to build around not having a $40 hitter, right? Like just kind of seeing like what happens if we go this way? All right, that looks all right. What if I do it this way at the beginning? Putting those bases together really gives you different ways to build, because you don't know exactly what's going to happen on draft day. One person in the room in the auction can push you off one of your foundational players. And the quicker you can pivot to plan B, plan C, plan D, the better off you're going to be. And there, you have to be flexible. You really have to be flexible in any league, but an auction especially. As much as you want to script it out, it can backfire on you very quickly if you're too rigid, if you're too locked into a very specific foundation.
Yeah, I had a really weird thing happen last year where I had two decision trees where I was like, one is Devers and one is Jose Ramirez. And I thought I'd get a little bit more speed from Jose Ramirez. So, you know, I could make some different decisions down in the outfield, maybe some power guys, you know what I mean? And one was Devers. And I, for some reason, I just liked the teams that I was building coming off of Devers. So I identified Devers. I was like, okay, I think he's going to be my $34, $35 guy. And the value spit out $33, $34. That's everything's going to go happy if I go that way. And he went for like $36. And I just couldn't bring myself to put that extra dollar on, you know? And so I was like, well, okay, now we're switching to the Jose Ramirez plan. At least that's my second plan. And I threw Jose Ramirez and I bought Jose Ramirez for $35. When the dollar sheet said like 33. So when it came, I went the extra dollar for Ramirez, and it was just a gut thing. And it worked out really well for me because, you know, I ended up second in the league and Ramirez has had a great season and the steals and everything. But I thought I'd screwed up. You know, I came out of the first break being like, why didn't I just put that extra dollar on Devers?
I think that's why it's important to know how many players are in each group, though. Mm. Like when you go through that, how many $30 players do you see? Because then you know if you're about to run out of $30 players you like.
That's why I went the extra buck on Ramirez, because it was later in the draft, right? It was later in the draft, and there was fewer $35 guys left. I was like, well, if I want to get a $35 bat, like this Ramirez is one of the last ones. Here we go.
Right. So you're going to adjust to the room a little bit, you know, at a certain point. If the room's paying +2, +3, +4 over the projections for top-end players, you're going to have to follow suit and pay a +2 or a +3 up top, knowing that later on, a couple of the $2 and $3 players are going to be $1 players. And if it keeps happening beyond the first 15, 20 players, sure, then those savings are going to extend up into the $4 and $5 players. Those guys will become $1 and $2 players if your $30 guys are all 33, 34, 35, right? Like the money spent earlier is going to come off the very bottom end of the pool as you start to make those adjustments. You don't want to have to pay +5 or +7 for an $18 player in the middle of the auction because you didn't buy enough production early on. I think that's a really, really hard lesson to learn for some people as they get into auctions for the first time. And I spend very aggressively, so fortunately, I haven't run into that problem in a very long time. Hopefully, I never run into that problem again. But looking at the NL pool, I'm so glad I'm in the NL and not the AL. I just think there are so many more interesting ways to build an NL-only team compared to an AL-only team. I feel like you get steered into a few more specific directions based on how the AL pool is built.
Well, if you're drafting in an AL-only situation, I would I would look at second base pretty hard. I don't know. I've said this about the old overall player pool, but AL second base is tough. AL pitching is pretty tough. There were some high profile moves from the AL to the NL. Some top arms, and so there is a bit of a, you know, 1-2 and then zoop, you know. So you have to really make a decision on, am I going to bid hard on those two? Or if I'm not going to bid hard on those two, who are the two number twos that I am going to, you know, go to $15 on? You know, if I'm not going to go to 38 on Shane Bieber, you know, who are the secondary guys that I think could anchor a staff? So those are the two things I would say that I'm thinking about. I don't want to give away too much, but those are things that I'm looking at. You know, I may make different decisions than you would looking at the same information, but I think that those are two key parts of the AL player pool in particular.
And if you are looking for really in-depth conversation about auctions, Ariel Cohen, the Beat the Shift podcast that he does with Ruvane Guy, they had me on as a guest to talk about auctions. It's like almost 90 minutes of auction analysis. Ariel's a great auction player too, so I would highly recommend checking out that episode if you're either just getting into auctions for the first time, or you're trying to kind of kick it up on their level and you want to get further down the rabbit hole of different things you can do to have a lot of success in a format like this. But I'm excited. I'm looking forward to the auction this weekend. It's one of my favorite weekends of the year. Bummed, of course, that we're not able to do it live, but still good to get together, jump on a Zoom, get to see some faces and hear the voices of some of our friends, and probably have a beer or two at the end of the evening anyway. We'll have a virtual fire pit or something. We'll find a way to make it work.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, got a few questions here, Eno, before we go. This first one comes from Kevin. It's about prospect platoon splits. Kevin's in a position with the second pick in his rookie draft, and he's choosing between Andrew Vaughn and Jared Kelnick. He's been leaning toward Kelnick for a while now, but one of the buddies he has in his league said he just hates lefties, which is really interesting. This had me wondering about his splits and whether the Mariners might mess around by platooning him. I think this is just a broader question, really. Like, do prospect platoon splits matter that much? And if they do matter, have we even seen enough from Jared Kelnick to believe that he, you know, can't hit lefties or can hit lefties, right? Like, I feel like it's one of these things that we really wouldn't know this early in his career. And how the Mariners handle him or how any team handles a young prospect also hinges on how the rest of their roster comes together and whether or not they even have someone they could easily platoon with that player.
Yeah, and then it's complicated by just the overall quality of the prospect and his the way that he'll hit the ground in the major leagues when he gets there. Because if you think about it, like a prospect for the Yankees, if you theoretically knew their platoon splits, you would ding them harder, right? Because the Yankees would actually use them that way. The Yankees are usually good. So if the guy gets to the major leagues and they know he has a platoon problem, they'll probably land him in a platoon situation. That's just who they are, you know? But the Mariners, I think, you're talking about a top two prospect in baseball right now, top three with Kalinic. And so you know, and they're not going to be so good that they're going to try and squeeze every ounce of production out of him when he first gets to the big leagues. So they're going to give him a lot more time. So I would say in the average position for a prospect, it would be more, it'd be more interesting to see how they're used at the major league level than it would be to know their minor league platoon splits. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think I'd worry about it too much with prospects. I think that a young player like a Miguel Andujar or like a, you know, like a young player that's like playing on a team where they're not using him in those positions. Could we have seen the Hunter Renfro's current situation by his prospect platoon splits, or would be who is Jock Peterson? Jock Peterson was a decently regarded prospect that came up with the Dodgers, and they only use him in platoon. So long-winded answer, I would say the organization matters as much. The organization and the landing situation matters as much as the actual platoon splits themselves, I think.
Right. And I think with Jock Peterson, like, he came up and was playing for a contender. And a contender is going to have depth, and a contender is going to be, you know, very, very adamant about making sure that the lineup is as good as it can be every day, because yeah, every single game matters. But player development matters more for a rebuilding team. I would say in Kelnick's case, I'm not worried about it. He's going to get chances. It's going to take him a few years in the big leagues before the Mariners look at him and say, we're not playing against lefties. I think he's going to be an everyday guy very soon after he comes up. So in that case, I wouldn't worry about it. It is the kind of thing that you know, you don't want to ignore. If a guy is striking out a lot more against lefties in the minors, yeah, you would care about that. But if you see even a 200-point difference in OPS, I think was what was pointed out from 2019, you're still talking about 1 year split across multiple levels where all those plate appearances against lefties, you're talking maybe, 100 to 125 plate appearances total. It's still such a limited sample that you'd be likely introducing something to your analysis that's hurting you more than helping you if you're reading too much into that. So don't ignore it, but don't make decisions based on that entirely. Some other examples of players he mentioned, yeah, Jock Peterson, Michael Conforto when he first came up at the very least, Jesse Winker. I get it. Like, it's a real thing to account for, but Kelnick's also, I think, going to be a decent defender too, which helps drive that playing time. Sometimes the guys that end up on big side platoons are left-handed mashers who are below average defenders.
Yeah, Winker's not a great defender.
And that kind of pulls them out of the lineup too, because then you got two reasons. You want to play the platoon advantage, and you want a better glove out there, because then you're getting an upgrade in two facets like that way.
Yeah. I suppose we could have seen Winker's platoon coming, I guess. I don't know.
Maybe.
But there are so many other ways he could have busted. The way that he turned out, I'm not complaining about. Like, he's a valuable major league player and a valuable fantasy piece. You know? Yeah, and he gets platoon. I don't know.
What about Alex Kirilloff?
Also, you'd rather have player. A lefty if they're going to end up getting platoon, right? I mean, you don't want,
then you're on the big
you
side.
You don't want Mike Brousseau.
But the other player that Kevin asked us about is Alex Kirilloff, who's supposed to come up and have a big role with the Twins.
Mm.
Do you see him being a little more vulnerable to possibly getting the early career platoon treatment?
That is a tougher one because the Twins are going to be good. They're going to try and win their division this year. Is Jake Cave a righty? Because that would give them, I think he probably is, just from the profile, I'm guessing.
Is Jake Cave a righty? No, Jake Cave's a
lefty. Whoa, really? So, Arise?
Play him in a corner?
Arise? Bats lefty too. Dude, maybe not.
I'm surprised they don't have a right-handed hitting outfielder.
Yeah, who's going to take his job? Rooker? Who's like a first baseman?
Not a good defender.
Not a good defender. That's interesting. Yeah, I think in this case, I would play that game. I'd play the depth chart game, and I'd look around, and I'd be like, I don't see an obvious person to platoon with him. I mean, I doubt they're going to put Keon Broxton out there instead of Alex Kirilloff.
You wouldn't think. I mean, Keon Broxton is a good emergency. If Byron Buxton's hurt, you get a good defender, has power and speed, but has a high K percentage. And
I would guess AAA depth.
Clear, like, 8-9 hitter. Yeah, he's more of a quad A sort of guy that is interesting, but definitely not a guy you're putting on the field at the expense of Kirilloff.
I got a text update. Beaver's sitting 93-94. But I was just podcasting, okay? I was just podcasting.
You were not at all reaching out to people on site to give you some scouting reports on how Beaver looked.
Exactly.
Nope,
not doing that at all.
Thanks a lot for that question, Kevin. It's a good question to think about when you're looking at young players, either to stash or for keeper, for dynasty, whatever the case might be. This next email got my attention because of the subject line. Subject lines are always important. RatesandBarrels@theAthletic.com if you go the email route. The subject line said, "I will send bottles of Jester King if you tell me this trade didn't suck." I'm going to open that email sooner than the other emails. So they're not always open in the order that they're received. Sometimes the more interesting subject line does get my attention. I'm sorry to admit that. The question comes from John. He's looking for brutal, honest feedback on an auto new trade that he made. He gave away Anthony Rendon, who is at $39, for Mark Canha at $5 and Brady Singer at $3. Was this a bleep trade? A more general question in this kind of format. How do you evaluate cheap points above replacement value guys, which is what I got, against the studs that guarantee you max points for a higher cost per point? Which is a common question that we're thinking about when we're looking at keeper questions and trying to decide what to do with rosters in formats like this. It's very common. This situation, I feel like I'd be telling a pretty big lie to get that Jester King, you know?
The Jester King is tempting.
Yeah, it's really tempting. I can't get that up here. I've never had it before, and I've only heard good things, and I like free beer. I like really good free beer even more, but
Prod me,
I would have held
me.
Anthony Rendon here. I understand, like, you run to a point in leagues with an in-season cap or with just a cap in general where you can't always keep the studs that you want to keep. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you got to take a guy like Rendon and say, all right, I got to turn Rendon into some younger, cheaper players. But Mark Canha's older than Anthony Rendon. So, you know, cheap and efficient, good. Like, he's the kind of guy that could be quickly in a bench role for Oakland. Mm-hmm. So I don't see a lot of long-term value there. Brady Singer's interesting, but not the kind of like frontline starter interesting that I would have
also
looked for as the main piece here. Plus, you're banking on long-term pitching, which adds a ton of risk.
Yeah, and also just generally the flow in Dynasty and Keeper is that the gold is young bats. So, mm-hmm. You went panning for gold with Anthony Rendon and came back with old and pitcher, which is the opposite of gold in fantasy, in dynasty fantasy. So I would say that, I don't love that trade. I you know, once had like a $62 Mike Trout in an auto new league, and I may not have gotten the greatest return. I got Roberto Osuna cheap, Vlad Guerrero cheap, like junior, and two pitching prospects. So the gold was for me Vlad Guerrero, who I then turned around into something else, and you know, the world turns on. But the point is that you gotta identify that gold, that one piece of gold that you're trying to get, and then you make them add stuff around it. So trading Rendon, probably a good idea. You probably would have had to do it in season, if not before the season. You do get a bunch of money, but money itself is, and this is an on your specific thing, money itself is not that amazing because the drafts are not that amazing. They're filled often with mid-30s bounce-back type players, which are not good bets. So the gold is still a 22 to 25-year-old young bat. And you just want to get that in every transition and transaction you have. And otherwise, keep Rendon and pay the money for the production.
Right. I mean, if this trade were Rendon at 39 for Nick Senzel at $5 and Brady Singer at $3, I could start to talk myself into it. Because Because then you get a guy that you could see being on your team for several years, being pretty underpriced, doing a little bit of everything. Like, that's more in line with where I'm at. I mean, how do you evaluate cheap points above replacement value guys like this? I just see them as highly replaceable. I don't see as much value in those players. Like, even though the points per dollar look good, that's replacement level or near replacement level, and I'd rather have that higher value player locked in, knowing that if it doesn't work out with guys in the bottom of my roster, I can find someone else that brings comparable upside to a Canna or a Singer. Like, those types of players enter the league pretty often, even in deeper auto new formats.
Yeah, I have like a super deep dynasty that I talk about sometimes on here, Devil's Rejects, and players like Andrelton Simmons, and we just took Hanser Alberto really late. Players that'll play, that might have a good, that might be landing in a good situation, might give you good points in a short term situation like that. They're a dime a dozen when it comes to dynasty, and they're not valuable in trades or valued in the draft. So they're fun to have, though. I mean, like, kind of how, like, this year will probably outproduce his $5 thing, but he won't have any trade value. He maybe end up just being a cut in next spring or once they bring in another outfielder or trade him or whatever it is.
All that said, look, you're going to make mistakes when you're new to a format. It's okay.
You also get Jester King.
It's going to ruin you forever.
Instead of sending it to us, drink it and yell at
drink
us.
Drink the Jester King.
And curse at
That's
us.
That's the move in this case. We did have a question back at the beginning of the pandemic. We were talking about a website to order local beer from around the country. You know, what's the latest with that site that you worked on?
In the meantime, a lot of the states have, the state beer coalitions or beer associations have put up stuff that where you can find which breweries are shipping in your state that way. There's been some other things that have popped up, but we had, supportbeer.com, and you can search by state and find out which breweries are. You can click, shipping in state, and you should be able to get a list of breweries that are shipping in your state. Otherwise, a place like Taver is pretty fun. That's a way that you can just order beer from all over the country that arrives in your mail. So that's Tavour. Pretty cool company.
It's Taver. It's not Tavour.
Well, listen, I thought it was Tajay. So
yeah, just TJ Anton.
I thought it was Taver like Saver, but
no, I thought it was Tavour like Devour, but I guess it could be both.
It's probably not Tajay Antone.
Yeah, both are possible.
I apologize to Mr. Antone and his family.
That much we know is true. Second question. I recently bought both Urquidy and Framber Valdez in a Keep Forever Dynasty League thanks to Eno's discussions on the pod. Does this make me a perpetual league winner for the next 3 to 4 years? And why is that answer 100% yes?
Yeah. Yeah. You've done it. Mic drop. Yeah. But I am doing, like I've said, I am kind of looking at pitchers with command as having a higher floor and maybe being more inning safe. Like the Alec Mills, JT Brubaker, Urquidy is like a little bit like that, but then also throws nasty stuff. So
Urquidy's getting some helium too, though. He's starting to creep up a little bit.
Sorry to anybody who already had him circled before I put my kiss of death on him.
Well, thanks a lot for the email, Baxter, and thank you for your email, John. As we said, enjoy that Jester King. No need to send it our way since we didn't approve of the trade that you sent our way. If you'd like to send us an email for a future episode, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com is the best way to do that. On Twitter, he's @Unosaurus. I am at Derek Van Riper. We've got our survey running. That'll be in the show notes. It's about all the podcasts we do here at The Athletic. If you take a few minutes to knock that out, we'd really appreciate your feedback. It'll help us make even better shows for you here on our network. If you have not signed up for The Athletic yet, you can get in for $3.99 a month, theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. Get Eno's pitching rankings, get all my rankings, get Jake Seeley's projections, get all the articles, everything in the draft kit included, plus, of course, all the team and league coverage you could possibly want, all for one low price. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.